Justice Resnick has had a death in the family and is therefore not here for oral arguments, but she will view the tapes and she read the briefs, and so she'll be participating in the decisions in the two cases we hear. First case is 03-565, State of Ohio versus Christopher Newton. Mr. Lowe.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your time there.
Christopher Newton's death sentence is invalid because the trial panel misunderstood and misapplied Ohio's capital selection process. Additionally, Newton should be excluded from the death penalty because of his serious mental illness. In proposition of law number one, Newton's trial panel misunderstood the capital selection process. As a result, the panel improperly weighed the facts of the murder as non-statutory aggravating circumstances and refused to consider mitigating factors and conducted an improper weighing process. Christopher Newton changed his plea from not guilty to guilty. As a condition of doing that, he requested the panel to weigh as mitigating factors his voluntary plea. The trial panel failed to consider this as mitigating factors. His change in plea was material to his decision to withdraw his not guilty plea. The trial panel further improperly weighed his mitigation. The trial panel misconstrued his childhood. The panel considered his parents, that their raising of him as substantially normal. But their parenting was not substantially normal. The evidence was contrary to that. Just because they celebrated his birthday and celebrated Christmas with presents does not make them normal parents. Nor does the fact that they sent him to an alternative school, because they were the only parents who did not participate in the educational plans. The evidence also showed that his father was extremely abusive, while his mother would not hold him accountable for his actions. These polar opposites gave him conflicting ideas during his formative years. The panel also violated his individual sentencing rights by comparing him to his siblings. Newton was the black sheep of his family. He was not taken on vacations. He was treated worse off than his other siblings. By comparing him to his other siblings, violated his individual sentencing rights. The trial panel also did not understand the purpose of mitigation. The trial panel believed that mitigation simply cancels out aggravating circumstances. This improperly shifted the burden from the state from proving that the aggravating circumstances outweighed the mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt. The panel also indicated that mitigation is an excuse for legal guilt. This is improper under State v. Williams and Lockett versus Ohio. The panel's confusion as to what mitigation constituted was evident from the record when they asked defense counsel after Dr. Ort testified why her testimony was mitigating because it was not linked to the murder. The panel clearly did not understand that this evidence was still relevant under the B7 mitigating factor. Most importantly, the trial panel improperly weighed non-statutory aggravators. They considered the facts of the killing as aggravating. They stated that the murder was sadistic and calculated, that Newton outweighed Brewer by 100 pounds, made the rope in front of him, and remained unremorseful. Facts of the crime can only be considered as mitigating factors under Ohio law. Newton's death sentence is unreliable and legally invalid due to the egregious errors of the sentencing panel. Newton's death sentence must be vacated and sent back for a new penalty phase. In proposition of law number 4, Newton urges this court to extend the United States Supreme Court ruling in Atkins versus Virginia to exclude the serious mentally ill from execution. Newton requests this court to take this step under its Eighth Amendment evolving standards of decency review to forbid the execution of the serious mentally ill. In Atkins versus Virginia, the United States Supreme Court held that individuals with mental retardation are less morally culpable for their crime because of the disabilities in the areas of reasoning, judgment, and control of impulses. This rationale was again upheld in excluding juveniles from execution in Roper versus Simmons. A death sentence is excessive because executing a mentally retarded person does not satisfy the objectives of capital punishment, that is, retribution and deterrence. There is no difference between mild mental retardation and serious mental illness. Both disabilities affect reasoning, judgment, and control of impulses. Both are placed on the DSM-4 Axis II because both disabilities affect reasoning and judgment. In fact, mentally ill individuals have a greater dysfunction than those experienced by most mild mental retardation.
Do we know what the status of his brain was the day of the murder?
Dr. Mossman was hired by the defense counsel to evaluate Newton. Dr. Mossman submitted an affidavit requesting to do a neuropsychiatric test, and the trial court declined to grant funds to perform that test. So at this point, we do not know what his mental condition was at the time of the crime. However, as our brief explains, prior to the crime, over 12 doctors diagnosed him with a litany of different psychotic disorders and was placed on at least 8 antipsychotic drugs, some including Haldol and Persidol, which are some very strong antipsychotic drugs.
Isn't the reason for a difference between in treating or considering someone with a serious mental condition that can be treated with drugs different from a person who has a severe mental brain defect? Isn't that a rational distinction between, the distinction upon which we would consider those two persons differently, and the reason the Supreme Court apparently has?
Well, the United States Supreme Court has not considered whether serious mental illness should be excluded.
But there's language, it seems to me, in the case that suggests that the fact that someone has a mental brain, what I call in my own language, brain damage versus a serious mental condition, as you're arguing, that's significant. You're right. We don't know what the U.S. Supreme Court would say to your argument, but there is a reason for a distinction, is there not?
I believe there isn't, because both disabilities affect reasoning, judgment, and control of impulses. And because it affects those areas, they are less morally culpable for their crimes to exclude them from being executed.
Mr. Lowe, are you saying your client has a serious mental serious mental illness, or is mildly retarded? Which is it?
Serious mental illness.
All right.
And he is not an individual with mental retardation.
And what is that illness?
His illness, as Dr. Ort testified, he has a borderline
personality,
which is listed in the DSM-4R as an Axis II disability and qualifies as a serious mental illness.
All right, thank you.
The other history of Newton labeled him with other serious mental illnesses.
Counsel, the legislative bodies and the courts have struggled with the McNaughton test and the not guilty by reason of insanity. Essentially, your approach here is that to impose death, you're not really arguing he's not guilty by reason of insanity. You're arguing that when you have a serious mental illness, that should make you ineligible for the imposition of the death penalty.
That is correct. Being an NGRI claim and an exclusion for the death penalty because of serious mental illness would be two different standards, is what we're asking. Most of the evidence shows that juries and sentencers who hear evidence of serious mental illness, even though it may be considered mitigating under most statutes, including Ohio's, that they believe once they hear evidence of serious mental illness, like being a juvenile and mental retardation, those most of the time got turned into an aggravating circumstance for future dangerousness. So relying on...
So, now, you're saying that is this a study or is this anecdotal, or it's your view that what should be an argument in favor of mitigation is turned into an argument in favor of aggravating a circumstance?
Under most statutes, like Ohio's, evidence of serious mental illness could be considered as mitigating.
Right.
But most juries will view that as an aggravating circumstance indicating an element of future
dangerousness. And how do we know
dangerousness.
That?
Studies have shown that. So just relying on Ohio's statute to permit serious mental illness as a mitigating factor would not be acceptable. We need to take the next step and exclude them from execution under the rationale of the United States Supreme Court in Atkins versus Virginia.
Do you have a sense of, it would seem to me there wouldn't be many cases left of people death eligible?
I would disagree. I do not believe there's that many individuals that would qualify for a serious mental illness exclusion.
How many other conditions qualify as a serious mental illness other than borderline personality disorder?
First, I would admit I'm not an expert in the areas of mental illness. And
well, you want us really to equate serious mental illness with mental retardation and fall under, as the Chief pointed out, what the U.S. Supreme Court said, we're not going to execute persons who are mentally retarded, even though your client has an IQ of 106 or so.
But IQ is not the lone factor for mental
retardation. It was in the retardation.
Pardon?
It was in the retardation cases.
IQ alone is not a lone factor for mental retardation.
If I understand your argument, you want us to equate serious mental illness with mental retardation as an exclusion for the death penalty.
That is correct, because both disabilities affect reasoning, judgment, and control of impulse.
And my question is, how many other conditions other than borderline personality disorder fall into that category?
There are several under the DSM-IV. I would urge this court to ask for further briefing from the professionals, the American Psychiatric Association, and those individuals who know what qualify more as serious mental illness to draw that distinction.
Counsel, you say that your client, at the time the crime was committed, was under a serious mental illness and lacked the ability to control impulses, to rationally analyze his actions, and to appreciate the consequences of his actions?
That is correct.
And would you say that about him today, currently?
I'm not a mental health expert, but once someone is diagnosed with a serious mental illness, as Newton was previously by over 12 doctors, That does not go away like mental retardation. It may be controlled by
It could be put into remission with the appropriate medication and therapeutic environment.
Correct. But it does not go away.
At the time of the proceedings, was his condition active? I'm curious as to the voluntariness of his plea here. If he was sufficiently stable in his illness or his condition to knowingly and voluntarily execute a plea, how does your argument play against that activity by your client?
Well, first, in proposition of law number 3, Dr. Mossman requested the funds to do the neuropsychiatric testing.
My understanding of that is that what would have transpired or taken place or evidence gathered at that point in time, according to the experts, may or may not be significantly different from at the time of the crime, or even weeks or days later.
But that test would have helped indicate whether he had a serious mental illness at that time or whether the plea would have been voluntary, was going to be my point.
Well, so, at what time, what did you or did counsel at the time want to use that diagnosis or diagnostic tool for?
They wanted to use it to help show that Newton's serotonin levels were low. Serotonin levels regulates the communication between the prefrontal association cortex and the limbic system.
And that's a fluctuating level from day to day, hour to hour.
Dr. Mossman believes otherwise.
As it's a constant?
He believes.
Medical evidence would state that that's a constant level?
If it's going to stay low, it's going to remain low.
Okay, so is it your contention that he was competent to execute the plea or not, or you don't know?
We have not raised that issue.
Okay.
Does your client have a history of being a malingerer, faking these symptoms?
There is evidence that he malingered, but Dr. Ort also testified that he malingered good also. So just because there's evidence that he malingered good, he faked good. So not only did he fake bad, but he faked good that he was well.
How does that play into your position?
I believe that should not be considered because the evidence, the court would have to believe that he malingered and fooled over 12 doctors that prescribed him with very strong antipsychotic drugs.
Well, several of the experts have indicated that they know that he can fake these symptoms.
Those are the ones that were hired by the state. The defense experts said that he was faking both. To go back and discredit over 12 doctors, I do not believe he has the ability to malinger that well. The question is whether the mentally ill are more deserving of death than people with mental retardation when suffering from the same disabilities.
Well, counsel, I want to come back to, your argument is tempting. It has some appeal because, as you know, from working at the public defenders, office, most of the death cases we see, the defendant has been disturbed in some fashion, some part of his life, or most of their life, or what they did seems so abhorrent that you can't imagine anyone who is in control of their faculties doing it. So it seems to me that if we went down the road that you invite us to go down, a strong, strong argument is going to be made in almost every case that this person is not death penalty eligible because of mental illness. And maybe that's right, maybe it isn't, but the question I'm getting to is, can't that be handled by further instruction from this court that judges need to be careful in the charge, judges need to exercise some real independent, which they're required to under the law, evaluation of that, because they've had an opportunity to hear all the testimony and see the defendant in court, which we don't have the opportunity to do. And that then we also are required to make an independent evaluation. So there are a number of opportunities to screen out those who have profound mental illness. We may not have done it to this point, but can it be done under the existing statutory framework without taking the entire leap that you're asking us to do?
I believe no, and the reasoning is because in the past, individuals with severe mental retardation and juveniles still ended up on death row. Unfortunately, the independent reviews have not been performed correctly. This court in State v. Clater did find that the mental illness was severe enough to render his execution inappropriate. However,
well, in some respects, you could make a pretty convincing argument that someone with profound mental illness may be less culpable than someone that's borderline mentally retarded. There are compelling reasons to think further about this issue, but it seems that the next step, I mean, if we were to follow you into the pool here, as you say, well, let's get the professionals in, and you're suggesting any mental illness that is of a certain classification, and I'm such a neophyte on this, I don't know those classifications, level 4, what did you call it?
From the DSM-4,
yeah.
It's on an axis 2.
Okay, well, I don't
which
understand
those are the disabilities that affect reasoning and judgment.
So you suggest that anything that rises to that level would, and that there could be various elements of mental illness that would put you in that category.
Correct. And mental retardation is placed on axis 2 of the DSM-4R. So those disabilities are similar, which require them to be excluded from death penalty eligibility, as mental retardation is by the Constitution under the Eighth Amendment. Newton presented evidence of a serious mental illness. Because serious mental illness and mental retardation share common characteristics, Newman urges this court to extend the reasoning of Atkins and, as urged by Justice Pfeiffer in State v. Scott, that it is time to take a step towards being a more civilized and humane society and forbid the execution of the serious mentally ill. Therefore,
Counsel. The distinction between the mental retardation and the mental illness, whether they're on axis 2 of the DSM-4, is the treatability of the mental illness, that the medications and the therapeutic environment and whatever other treatments are available can cause those illnesses to be in remission, whereas mental retardation is a physiological brain condition that We can't improve. You can't get better. You can't cure mental retardation. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes and no. Mental illness may be treated with medication and put in remission, but it is continually there.
I understand
like
that.
Mental retardation.
I understand that. But the medication is successful in many instances, and your client was being treated with medication.
At what point in time? At the time of the crime, no, he was not.
And was that because it was the decision of his treating physicians not to give him medication, or did he discontinue medication?
At the time, the prison records that were submitted at trial indicate that the doctors believed that he did not need medication.
So in their professional opinion, at certain points he was treated with medication while incarcerated. There, I think, is even evidence in the record that at times he intentionally manifested symptoms so that he could get medication. So he had a history both of taking medication on therapeutic levels as well as abuse of psychotropic medications, correct?
But there's also evidence that he faked good, and at that time he could have been faking good when he does have a mental illness that required him to be medicated.
Well, whatever in the professional opinion of the treating physicians within the institution, he was at a level that they felt was, for lack of a better term right now, is in remission.
They did not use remission, so I do not know the official diagnosis. But if you were to look at the facts of Newton after he committed this crime, that was very bizarre behavior. It was almost childlike and with unpredictability.
And could that have been another example of your client's manipulative role-playing for the purposes of accomplishing his goal?
It could be an indication of a severe mental illness.
And it could be also his manipulative skills exhibiting themselves that he'd learned over many years of perfecting it, correct?
Highly unlikely with his severe mental illness.
Are you asking us to overrule Scott?
In effect, yes, to the extent that serious mental illness should be excluded from the death penalty.
Okay. How many other cases would there be that would also be overruled in that?
I know Justice Wright dissenting in State v. Berry indicated that the serious mentally ill should be excluded, so the opinion in State v. Berry would need to be revisited also.
Thank you.
Therefore, under the Eighth Amendment, evolving standards of decency, this court should recognize that severe mentally ill individuals are less morally culpable. Therefore, Newton's death sentence must be vacated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe. Mr. Collier.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Collier, and with Kirsten Gartner, we represent the state of Ohio in this matter. I'd like to follow the same order that Mr. Lowe followed, covering first the trial court weighing error proposition of law, and then the third proposition of law regarding mental illness as an exemption from the death penalty. It is true that Mr. Newton conditioned his plea on asking the court to consider his plea as a mitigator at the penalty phase. I guess there are three things that we would like to point out to the court. State versus Ashworth, a case that is cited by Mr. Newton, this court found the same type of situation. The trial court in that case had not considered Mr. Ashworth's guilty plea as a mitigator. This court cured that failure to consider it as a mitigator through the court's independent weighing. One of the other things to note is that defense counsel in this case didn't argue at the penalty phase that the court should consider the guilty plea to be a mitigator. Now, we cited one brief passing reference to the fact that he had pled guilty was mentioned during the defense counsel's closing argument. But in as much as this was not a feature of the defense presentation at the penalty phase, it was understandable for the court to not spend any time discussing the mitigatory effect of it. And that's the third point that we would raise regarding this. Unlike Ashworth, which did not occur in a prison setting, the fact that Mr. Newton agreed to plead guilty in this case really is not that grand of a gesture on his part. It isn't as though he could blame somebody else for this crime. He'd confessed to it already. This really wasn't something that was going to be in dispute, so the guilty plea wouldn't be entitled to as much weight as it might otherwise be in other cases. On the issue of the misconstrued mitigation, the trial panel did discuss the fact and did use the term that his family appeared to be substantially normal. We would note for the court that the panel did say that it was at least of minimal consequence, so it's not as though the court precluded it from its consideration as mitigation. And I think that the record bears out the court's conclusion on that. These were parents who stayed together for the benefit of the children. They worked shifts that at least provided for one parent to be home at all times with the kids. There was testimony that the mother had, in fact, coddled Mr. Newton. So I think rather than showing that that is somehow abnormal, that was evidence that the family life was at least substantially normal. The parents did not abuse alcohol or drugs. The trial panel specifically found that there was no sexual abuse by the parents. There was some evidence that there was physical abuse, but I think Mr. Newton's brother even testified that, at least at that time, that wasn't particularly uncommon for that type of discipline. And the fact that the parents provided for three different types of special education classes to try and get Mr. Newton back on track was also indicative that this was a family that was trying to function as a substantially normal family. The other factor that Mr. Newton had argued is that the trial panel compared Mr. Newton to his siblings. And I think it's important to note that really there the panel was just engaging the effect of this upbringing, the fact that he did have some difficulties with his parents with some physical abuse. The fact that the siblings who were brought up in this same environment didn't turn out the way that Mr. Newton did, I think was something that the court could comment on as a way of saying that this upbringing really wasn't entitled to much mitigatory weight.
Counsel, could you comment on the fact mentioned by Mr. Lowe that the panel may have taken the gruesome nature of the case and improperly considered it as aggravating rather than mitigating? The way the statute is written is really counterintuitive. Normally, people would think that the gruesomeness of a crime should be an aggravating circumstance. The way our statute is written, of course, nature and circumstances are only to be considered as mitigating in contrast to the specification that is the only aggravating factor. Would you comment on that, please?
Sure. I think what this highlights is something that actually jumps us to, I think it's the eighth proposition of law, and it's one that this court has rejected time and time again, and it is an anomaly that's brought up by the way the legislature drafted this, because the statute in one section does command the trier of fact to consider the nature and circumstances of the aggravating circumstance. Elsewhere, though, it does, and this court has held in State versus Gum and State versus Wogenstahl, that you can't consider those nature and circumstances to be an aggravator. I think what's important to point out here is that the trial court opinion, the sentencing opinion, is very clear on the subject of what was considered to be an aggravating circumstance, what was considered to be mitigation. And so it's at, I believe, page 4 of the sentencing opinion where the court lays out that the aggravating circumstance in this case is just the specification that the murder was committed in a detention facility.
Were there oral statements, though, that contradicted the sentencing opinion?
Early on, and we would concede that, early on you could tell that at least there was preliminary discussion that would indicate that the court wasn't sure how to consider aggravating circumstance and the nature and circumstances of the crime. But ultimately, it's the opinion that counts. And in the end, when they make their decision about whether to impose the death penalty, the opinion sets out the aggravating circumstance, the only thing that can be considered on that side of the scale, they have correctly identified. Now, in the conclusion section, you're right, there is a discussion about the way the crime was committed. In fact, in mentioning State versus Ashworth, the trial court's discussion mirrors pretty closely the way this court discussed Mr. Ashworth's sentence in the course of this court's independent sentence review. So certainly the court didn't have to ignore the way this crime was committed, but the opinion shows that the court wasn't turning that into an aggravator, that the court had recognized its duty to only weigh on that side of the scale the specification that was set out by the statute.
Mr. Collier, the main thrust of the presentation by Mr. Lowe seemed to focus on our decision in State versus Scott, where we rejected the invitation of the defendant to eliminate the death penalty for those with serious mental illness. His position is that because serious mental illness can be equated with mental retardation, we should make the move and consider overruling Scott. Did you want to comment on that?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. I would turn now to the third proposition of law. And in discussing that, I would like to get to that second. The first thing I would like to address, though, is Chief Justice Moyer had asked exactly what was this guy's condition at the time of the crime. And there certainly is a dispute in the record as to what type of mental illness Mr. Newton was suffering from at the time of the crime, and indeed at the time of trial. And then second, I would like to address the standard that Mr. Newton is advocating in this case. It's important to recognize that there was no insanity plea in this case, and perhaps even more important than that, to the extent that the mental illness is at play at all, even Mr. Newton's own expert didn't testify that he could meet the B3 mitigator for mental disease or defect that substantially affected his capacity to understand the wrongfulness of his conduct or conform his conduct to the requirements of law. So to the extent that he does have mental illness, and there was agreement among experts that he did have mental illness, it was not even the type that rose to the level of the B3 mitigator, much less any type of insanity or incompetence. Mr. Newton's expert, Dr. Ort, Mr. Newton's retained expert, Dr. Ort, testified in the penalty phase that she essentially found three diagnoses for Mr. Newton. The first was polysubstance abuse in remission, and all the experts agreed on this. So to the extent that that was a diagnosis, everybody agreed that was not in play at the time of this crime, nor is it in play at the time of trial. So while that was a diagnosis, it was not active at any of the relevant times in this case. She also found that Mr. Newton suffered from a mood disorder not otherwise specified. Now, one of the things that the state's expert had testified, Dr. Sorrentino, was that diagnosis isn't even in DSM, and that's at page 615 of the transcript. The third diagnosis that she arrived at, though, the one that everybody agreed on, was some form of antisocial personality disorder. And as all the experts testified to some degree or another, this was essentially a characteristic of not conforming to the requirements of the law. And in fact, Dr. Sorrentino had put it into mathematical terms to answer Justice Pfeiffer's question about really what type of group are we talking about that would fit into this category. She had testified that in the prison population, we're looking at 85% suffer from some type of substance abuse disorder, that it's 60 to 70% suffer from an antisocial personality disorder, that it's 60% that suffer from some type of borderline personality disorder. So in response to your question about is this going to be a small subset or a big subset, the testimony in this record is that it would be a very large subset of the total number of death-eligible capital defendants who would then be able to claim this exemption.
How does his condition match up with, in Scott, it was schizophrenia, as I believe. Where is that on the pecking order as you see it in terms of I assume even most prosecutors agree there are some folks who may not, the McNaught test is tough, and it would be no right from wrong. To be not guilty by reason of insanity is a very, very hard thing to do, but there are many others who come within the grasp of the criminal justice system who suffer from various degrees of mental illness, and some more debilitating than others, some having more effect on your judgment and your ability to control yourself than others. So how would you compare this defendant with Scott in terms of the mental illness? Because I'm sure no expert on that. I don't claim to be knowledgeable on this.
Well, it's a good question, and it's also one, though, that even the experts in this case highlighted as one that really doesn't have an identifiable answer. In fact, Dr. Ort, in cross-examination, had testified, the prosecutor had asked about, well, is this axis one or axis two? Isn't axis one, which schizophrenia that Mr. Scott had, would be considered the most serious? And she had testified, and this is at page 482 of the transcript, that you can't classify them that way. They don't go axis one is the most serious, two is then the next level down, then three and four. They don't work that way. They're just different categories. So we don't have in this record really a way of saying that that in terms of classification that Mr. Newton is on a par with Mr. Scott. He's the next axis down, but as Dr. Ort said, they're different criteria. One of the things I've...
So in terms of helping the three-judge panel make an evaluation as to how much mitigation to award that compared with looking at other cases that they can look in the books and, you know, look to Scott and see our discussion of that, mm-hmm. The classification is not necessarily helpful
right.
to them in terms of deciding how much mitigation weight should this receive.
Right. And I think you see that in the transcript with the questions by one of the panel members about what am I supposed to do with mood disorder? How is that really any different than diabetes? And I think that the first part of your question really gets to the type of criteria that a trial panel would employ. And we know that, or we have that from the state legislature. We have insanity, which takes you out of the whole penalty phase altogether. But more importantly, we have what I guess euphemistically is called insanity light, the B3 mitigator. So even if you can't meet that heightened standard that you were talking about, there is a safety valve, I guess, for people who don't quite meet that, but could meet the substantially affected by mental disease or defect of the B3 mitigator.
Is there any, are you aware of any effort among like the Prosecutors Association to look at this and help you all as prosecutors decide what to screen out? Just as the prosecutor O'Brien here has said on the highly publicized case, now that he knows all the mental illness information, much of which wouldn't have been available to him at the time that he made the initial decision as to what to charge, is there an effort to try and agree among yourselves as prosecutors as to what initial screening might be brought to bear in making the call as to whether or not this is a death-eligible case or should be handled that way?
I'm not aware of an effort in the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association to do that, and I am somewhat familiar, at least through the media reports, of Mr. O'Brien's decision on that. I guess what I would say, at least with regard to this case anyway, is, and I know there was discussion about all the different psychotropic medication that Mr. Newton had been on at any given time. It is important to recognize that at least for about a year before this crime, he was on no medication. That all three of the experts who testified in the penalty phase, including his own expert, Dr. Ort, basically disagreed with the prison diagnosis that he suffered from any type of schizophrenia. And Dr. Ort testifies to that at page 466. And she also admits at 487 that he does feign mental illness. And so that does take him out of the realm of like the sniper or even Mr. J.D. Scott in terms of schizophrenia, that that we don't have that at play here. In fact, we have Dr. Oden's testimony that, quote, I don't think he had any significant mental illness that was present at the time of the murder, at page 557. So the two states experts said there was no severe mental illness. Dr. Sorrentino had talked about how even her diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder was not severe. It could be in some people if they were to lose touch with reality, but everybody agreed that Mr. Newton was in touch with reality. So on this record, even if we're going to go with some kind of a vague, as they're suggesting, classification of severe mental illness, Mr. Newton doesn't meet that. And that's one of the other things, to get back to Justice O'Donnell's question about what standard are we applying here and where we fall in, is does it have to be access to or above? I think that's something that's very telling about their argument, that to equate his mood disorder, if that's what we're going to go with Dr. Orr, or an antisocial personality disorder with mental retardation doesn't have any logic behind it, and it doesn't have, I guess, the benefit of being a straight line, since we have even disagreement among the experts about what Mr. Newton suffers from in this case. And I think, you know, Dr. Orr had even testified to this, that in talking about the prison evaluations, that Mr. Newton is very complex, and she could understand, quite frankly, how they would have difficulty assessing what exactly he was suffering from. And that when he shows up and says that he hears voices, essentially the psychiatrist looking at him has to believe that that's the case and prescribe medication based on that representation. I'd like to spend some time and discuss the case law basis that's provided for this court to make this giant step to now exclude severely mentally ill people from the death penalty. And one of the things that the court will note in looking at the two U.S. Supreme Court cases that they've cited, in Atkins versus Virginia and Roper versus Simmons, the very first thing that the U.S. Supreme Court did in both of those cases was ask, was there objective indicia that society had morally moved to a point where, in Atkins' case, the mentally retarded shouldn't be subject to the death penalty, and for Roper's case, the juveniles shouldn't be subject to the death penalty. And in both of those cases, they look principally and primarily at two things: what were the state legislatures doing, and what was the state practice? Were the states across the country actually carrying out executions of the mentally retarded or the juveniles? And in both those cases, the Supreme Court noticed a distinct trend that was going toward exempting these people. They had noted in Atkins that 15 states had moved since the time that Penry was decided, allowing execution of the mentally retarded, 15 states had moved to exempt the mentally retarded. In Roper, I believe it was 5 states had moved toward excluding juveniles from being subject to the death penalty. In this case, Mr. Newton has provided the court with no legislature has moved to exclude the mentally ill from the death penalty. Now the court, Mr. Newton has provided the individual opinions of 3 justices on that point, but again, going back to the Trop versus Dulles test that the Supreme Court followed in both Atkins and Roper, they provided no legislative indicia that the severely mentally ill should be excluded. In fact, if we were to look at the legislative indicia, we know that the legislature in this state has accounted for mentally ill by providing statutes on insanity. We now have a specific statute implementing Ford versus Wainwright so that we don't execute people who don't understand why they're being executed and the fact that they're being executed. And we have specifically in the death penalty phase the B3 mental disease or defect mitigator. So on that first objective indicia, we have our state legislature saying mental illness is to be considered, to the extent it doesn't meet any of these other statutes, is to be considered a mitigator, not an exemption. The other thing is, the second factor is the state practice. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court looked to see if states were actually executing the mentally retarded and the juveniles, and the court was seeing very little evidence that that was in fact occurring. As Justice Pfeiffer has pointed out, and I only handle capital cases, it's very difficult to think of any capital defendant who's come before this court without some form of mental illness. Now, you can argue the range of mental illness, and as you pointed out, J.D. Scott, with the schizophrenia, might be at the upper end of that, but to the extent that they're arguing mental illness such as antisocial personality disorder should qualify, that's gonna sweep within it a lot of people. So the practice is, we have been executing people who have some form of mental illness, but the legislature has taken that into account and tried to identify the categories of those people who shouldn't be subject to it, the insane or the incompetent, and the people who have lesser forms do get the chance to present that as mitigation.
Do you recall what Mr. Berry's condition was, volunteer?
I believe he also had schizophrenia or some form of schizophrenia.
Former Justice Wright dissented in.
Yes.
And that went on the same basis that I dissented in Scott.
Correct. And that's, I guess that would also highlight part of the difficulty in trying to draw a distinction just based on, can I call a doctor to say that this is a severe mental illness? As they did, Dr. Ort said these are all severe. The state's expert said no, they're not. Is that you have people like J.D. Scott or Wilford Berry who might be at the upper end in terms of schizophrenia, but even that isn't a satisfying category by itself. I noticed on the court's website that there is a court conference on mental illness in the criminal justice system that Justice Stratton is participating in. I noticed the keynote speaker in that conference, Dr. Freeze, has a history of schizophrenia. So the fact that we can hit a label of a mental illness shouldn't result arbitrarily in a automatic exclusion from being subject to the death penalty. One of the other examples is Dr. Ord had testified that the then president, anyway, of the American Psychological Association had bipolar disorder, another Axis I diagnosis. So just merely hitting these categories isn't enough, and we would argue that the legislature has already contemplated how these things are to be considered, that you can present this evidence, and then it's up to the trier of fact to determine, can you meet the B3 mitigator, and then even if you don't, can you go down to the B7 catch-all? And that would be entitled to any weight. And I think what's significant in this record is that all the experts pretty much agreed that he didn't meet the B3 mitigator, he didn't meet insanity, and they really couldn't even specifically relate his mental disease to the crime at issue. If there are no further questions from the court, the state would ask this court to affirm the conviction and sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Collier. Mr. Lowe, you've saved 2 minutes of your time.
Counsel, I'm trying to recall, and I should remember, and I don't. Is this the first time that this issue has been presented to this court in the direct appeal? The Scott case was coming back to us in the final stages where that argument was, where we wrestled with that argument. But is this the first time that this direct request to eliminate certain categories of defendants from being death eligible?
Yes,
it has come up in a direct appeal.
Yes, it is, and that's why we are asking this court to evaluate this under the Eighth Amendment's evolving standards of decency standard. In State v. Clater, this court did not have that exemption, but looked at it under
and
its
independent
review.
And when Justice Wright raised this in Berry, of course, you did not have. The Supreme Court had not moved to make juveniles and mentally retarded defendants ineligible.
That is correct. In Connecticut, their statute forbids the execution of those with mental capacity, which significantly impairs defendant's ability to conform conduct to the requirements of the law, but not so impaired to constitute a defense to prosecution. This is what we're asking this court to do. This is not guilty by reason of insanity. This is not incompetency. We are asking this court to exclude those who are above incompetency and insanity, but who are seriously mentally ill, to forbid the execution of those individuals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.